Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website www.thecritic.co.uk to subscribe today. Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. In this edition, Professor Jeremy Black, author of A History of the British Isles, talks to The Critic's deputy editor, Graham Stewart, about the role of the Queen and the Queen Consort in British and European history.
Professor Jeremy Black, when we think of the Dark Ages, we would perhaps naturally assume that women weren't accorded senior roles in society. But actually, one of the figures we know one of the figures who is most familiar to us from the early years of the first millennium is Boadicea, Queen Boudica. What do we know about the powers that were invested in women as heads of their tribe and subsequently heads of their nation?
Well, that's an excellent question. I'm not sure, incidentally, we would usually have the Dark Ages as going that far back. I think we'd call it late Iron Age Britain. But Boudica's an example, and indeed the Brigantes in northern England are another example later that century. One of the problems is that we know most essentially through hostile voices, Roman historians, and that is not the best way to necessarily understand them. And indeed, I was thinking of the Brigantes that this was discussed in my book on 18th century British historians, or English historians. I commented on one of them who wrote about the early history of Northern England, and he commented on her and talked about the extent to which the Romans had spread stories about lasciviousness and so on, and in order to disparage her, because of course the Romans, their emphasis was on male rulers, and they classically, most famously with Cleopatra, Queen of Egypt, had a down on societies that put women forward. So I don't really feel we know enough from sources that are inherent to those societies to comment much about it. And indeed, as we go on into the Dark Ages, we do know that there were females in prominent positions. We can think, for example, in the early 9th century, the so-called Lady of the Mercians, of course. We could think of King Canute's wife. We know that women were prominent. I think it's fair to say that their position was generally marginal vis-a-vis male rulers. Male rulers, of course, have the attributes of warriors, which I think was a particularly distinctive role, and also was linked to the extent, as we were discussing last time in our comments on monarchy and religion, that the rulers as warriors were also the defenders of the church, and particularly so against pagans, including Vikings initially before they converted. So I think I would say that if we are looking at women rulers, really, although there are these earlier instances, we probably should start with Henry I's daughter, Matilda, and the War of Succession, the war in which she is pitched against King Stephen. Not least because that was a struggle about which quite an amount was written at the time by chroniclers.
Well, that period, it, of course, is known as the Anarchy. Do you sense that the battle between Matilda's supporters and Stephen's supporters was really down to judgments on who could win, who had the better claims to legitimacy? Or were Stephen's supporters really motivated by a sense that, you know, we don't want Matilda because she's a woman?
Well, I certainly think her being a woman had a major problem, was a major problem, but also, of course, an aspect of her being a woman, and an aspect that was always significant when you were looking at female rulers, which was the extent to which there was the question of whom she was going to marry. And I think that was very, very important because the Count of Anjou, Geoffrey, her husband, was unwelcome to quite a few of the Anglo-Norman nobility. As far as the Civil War itself is concerned, I mean, Matilda famously wasn't popular with London, which obviously affected the way she was perceived. The problem was neither monarch enjoyed clear success. And one of the consequences of that is they found it hard to maintain support, the cohesion of the Anglo-Norman ruling group. And indeed, also, they were unable to demonstrate success or clear success either as warriors or in terms of the providential support of the church. I mean, Matilda kept in the struggle. That was impressive. It's interesting to note that King Stephen's wife, another Matilda, plays, as it were, a heroic role when her husband hits difficulties, in that she continues the struggle. So it's not the case that it's man versus woman is some clear juxtaposition. I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that Queen Matilda, not Stephen's wife, some of her major supporters are male, Robert Earl of Gloucester, for example, her husband, Geoffrey, subsequently her son, the future Henry II, whilst King Stephen's, as it were, heroic supporter is his wife. So I wouldn't like to have it as a clear male versus female in sort of consideration. But what I think it does bring out is the extent to which, however legitimate a female ruler was, and to an extent in that period, to an extent with the Norman rulers, there is a degree to which the monarch designates their successor, and of course a process eased by the fact that you can divide Normandy from England, as you see, for example, with the inheritance of William I. So a monarch designates their successor, which means you're not inherently having to have a male ruler, but nevertheless, the nature of the job, the nature of the post, the nature of the responsibilities mean that they are more conducive for male candidates.
It's an interesting point that you raise about worries about, you know, Matilda's husband and Geoffrey and what power he would have. And there were similar problems, we'll come to it later, but with Queen Mary.
Let's come to it now, because Philip, in a way, many of these issues do leap the centuries. I mean, there was a comparable issue with Queen Mary, which we can talk about, but also there was a comparable concern in the case of whom Queen Victoria was going to marry. And you might argue that the change that you see in the marital conventions of the royal family in the 20th century makes this less of an issue, because a British monarch, if female, is not likely to marry another monarch whom would be head of state of another country. But in the case of Queen Mary, just to remind listeners, she was queen in her own right from 1553 to 1558. She marries King Philip II of Spain, who of course is a close relative, that goes without saying. And that is contentious, leads to Wyatt's Rising, Thomas Wyatt's Rising in Kent in 1554, precisely because it is seen as likely to affect the independence of England, as well as the issues of religion and foreign policy. Interestingly enough, and obviously we tend, when we're talking about to England, to completely forget about Scotland. But in the case of Scotland, you go back to the medieval period. There is the issue, obviously, with the maid and her death, and this call bringing forward the English claim to the succession in the 1290s. There is then the issue, of course, of the ruling monarch marrying first the King of France, that's Mary Queen of Scots we're talking about in the 16th century, then after he dies, marrying the again a cousin, Darnley, and then after he's murdered, running off with the her second husband's likely murderer, which does not, as it were, endear her to her critics in Scotland. So there are practical problems. I mean, you could argue that Mary, Queen of Scots, would have been in a happier position domestically, by domestically, I mean in terms of internal politics, if she hadn't had three successive partners, but instead had followed, as it were, the position of Elizabeth Tudor.
Well, what was the legal tradition? We're not talking about something that's necessarily codified. The legal tradition in terms of a queen in her own right and her choice of consort. I've seen, you know, documents when Mary Tudor was queen where it says you. Queen Mary and King Philip, so as if they are co-regents in the way in which William and Mary were co-regents. But that isn't legally the case, or is it a case, you know, it wasn't the case in law, but it was the case in reality, and therefore you, whoever you're married to, that person effectively as the man is perceived to have the stronger influence on the queen.
Yes, well, thank you. Can I just say, for the benefit of listeners, when you were referring to William and Mary, what we are meaning here is William III, of William of Orange, and his wife, Mary II, who are monarchs from 1689 until the death of Mary of smallpox in 1694, whereupon William III continues to rule in his own right. So I just thought I'd better mention that. They are indeed, as you correctly say, constitutionally co-rulers in a way that had not been the case earlier. So in other words, earlier, let us say Elizabeth I had got married, and after all, there were a number of suitors, including the Duc d'Alençon, for example, a brother of the three successive kings of France. And I think I'm right in saying there was talk potentially of an Austrian archduke. I can't remember whether that was Maximilian, the chap that becomes Maximilian II. At that stage, the supposition would be that, yes, Elizabeth's role would be circumscribed by having a husband who would be a figure in international politics, but that in constitutional terms, England would remain a distinct unit and therefore not bound by in inheritance terms, by the marriage. So that, as you correctly say, Philip of Spain, when Mary dies in 1558, that's it. He has no claim on the situation in England. And there are examples, of course, in the accretion of territories by the Habsburgs, in which such claims had arisen, but that was not the case in the 1550s. So you are right that there is a tension between the constitutional assumption that any monarch, male or female, in no way represents a limitation constitutionally by their marital choice, or indeed their choice for no or marriage. But you are also right that any monarch, male or female, by their marriage is assumed to have linkages. Now, we are talking about the way in which female monarchs would be assumed to have linkages because of their husbands. But it's worth bearing in mind that if you're looking at Henry VI, who marries Margaret of Anjou, there is an assumption that this marriage is pushed through in order to ease relations with France in the latter stages of the Hundred Years' War. There is also the assumption used by Yorkist critics around Richard, Duke of York, that this represents an unwarranted degree of pro-French influence over Henry 6th, and I think both of those charges are justified. So a man's marriage can also compromise you, and even as powerful a figure as Henry VIII, who was not exactly a pushover by any stretch of the imagination, there is no doubt that he was influenced to a degree by, I mean, he both influences, as it were, but is also influenced to a degree by those whom he marries. And that is a long-standing convention. I've just been reading The Grub Street Opera by Henry Fielding last night. And this is an opera, burlesque opera of 1731, in which it's talking about a family in England. But it is actually an analogy about the royal family, and it's making fun of the extent to which George II is pushed around by his wife, Queen Caroline. So, you know, the notion that that we are only talking about the female issue is one we have to be cautious. The issue of queens in their own right is one we have to be cautious about.
And with this role of queen consort, I mean, does it have any formal powers? And I'm thinking all the way, I mean, you mentioned Margaret of Anjou. Henry VI happened to be a spiritual weak monarch, and you know, in the middle of a dynastic civil war, the Wars of the Roses, in which Margaret of Anjou, as the much stronger figure, played a very leading a leading role. But is it just a matter of the fact the queen consort has no powers unless the king assigns her particular authority to act on his behalf, or there is some reason why the king is incapacitated, as Henry VI, for example, was incapacitated for part of his rule? Or is there anything that one can point to which says that it was expected that a queen consort would have certain powers?
Well, again, that's an excellent question. What I would argue is answer to that is we are talking about ad hoc situations. A queen is the obvious figure, who is a consort, is the obvious figure to consider as a regent if the queen is fit and able, and if the male is either unfit or, as indeed frequently happened, away for reasons of politics or campaigning. So that I've already mentioned George II's wife, Caroline, where she never accompanies her husband on his trips to Hanover, which I suppose is just as well, because on at least one of the trips whilst she's arrived alive, and probably two of them, he's having a relationship with Madame Volmolsen, and I think the Queen would have been in the way a bit. But she, in effect, is running the government, with the assistance of Sir Robert Walpole, running the government back in London in his lengthy absences. Now, that is not a campaigning absence. That's an absence to go back to the native Hanover, to be Kurfürst, elector, and to enjoy the chase of animals and women. But you get, in the medieval period, you get instances of monarchs leaving London or leaving the centre of politics and governance and having to leave a regent-like figure. But whatever is the formal process, the informal process is really crucial, because it is the relationships, as indeed one's got with the sovereign, the relationship between the sovereign and the leading aristocracy, between the sovereign and their ministers, many of whom are among the ranks of the aristocracy. These are crucial, irrespective of whatever document has been drawn up. So we mentioned earlier that William III and Mary II were in effect co-rulers from 1689 to 1694. That is true. But I would argue that actually Mary II has less power than Queen Caroline did, even though Queen Caroline is not a co-ruler. Mm. So I think one has to be careful, and vice versa, if you're thinking about it in terms of female rulers. I mean, one thinks, for example, of Queen Anne, who is Queen Mary II's younger sister. Queen Anne is sovereign in her own right from 1702 to 1714. For her last years, she's a widow. But prior to that, she's married to Prince George of Denmark. And I think it's fair to say that although Prince George is not the complete non-entity that he is sometimes portrayed as, nevertheless, he is not a proto-Prince Albert in the making. So I think a lot of it does depend upon personality, but nobody would have known that. I mean, you know, in a way, there are the two sisters. One of them marries William of Orange. The other one marries George of Denmark. They are both Protestant princelings. George is actually, in a way, in some respects, dynastically more senior because he is actually the son of a royal. I think it's fair to say that it would have been hard, you would have been hard pressed to have said that definitely one was going to be the stronger personality than the other. Just as, I mean, if you want to use the comparison of the half sisters, Mary Tudor and Elizabeth Tudor. So I think personalities do come into it to a great extent. Again, in the 20th century, the contrast in terms of sobriety and sense of service between George VI, who excels in both of those, and Edward VIII, who doesn't, but they're both brothers.
Well, Mary Tudor, Queen Mary I, and her sister Elizabeth I, both very strong personalities, both very, very determined rulers. Can we say they redefined the nature of queenship at all as a consequence of that, or does it just come down to the point you've really made that it, you know, circumstance and the nature of an individual character is all really in the defining of these roles? The role is only defined by its occupant at the time.
Well, that's an excellent point. I mean, I think both. I mean, I'm a great believer in the short term, the ad hoc, and the contingent. So I would be naturally predisposed to take the latter view. But if one wants to look at the former view, I think you could say that the potential of a stronger monarchical state offered by Henry VII and then Henry VIII, particularly with administrative strengthening, with Henry VIII's taking over the, you know, the effective headship of the church, etc., etc., is compromised by Edward VI, who is too young and, you know, dies too soon, and then by Mary and Elizabeth. Now, I don't want to say it's compromised simply for those reasons. I mean, Henry VIII compromised his own position in an extent by taking part in expensive and to a degree unnecessary wars with France and Scotland in his later years, which meant that he had to sell most of his assets that he'd gained from the dissolution of the monasteries. Because it's very easy for me to make some sanctimonious remark to that effect. There's no way that a modern British government would ever take part in unnecessary wars and waste large sums of money. But you at least are smiling at that. But going back to the 16th century, I mean, you can broaden this ad hoc nature. You could say, as a parallel to what I'm talking about, that the potential of the Scottish monarchy created by James IV and James V was compromised to a degree by Mary, Queen of Scots. Or you could say, actually, what really made the difference was James VI going south in 1603 and Charles I being such a twit. Or you could say, if we're looking at the French comparison, and the French comparison is always interesting, that the roles of both Catherine de' Medici and Marie de' Medici showed that women behind the scenes could be extraordinarily significant, even if they do not become monarchs. And I think that, you know, one has to allow for the role of contingency. And I myself would be disinclined to take a view that female rulers necessarily weakens some the situation. I mean, the obvious example of that is 18th century Russia. 18th century Russia has four sovereign tsarinas. So in other words, tsarinas in their own right, not as a result of being married. Catherine I, well, she's only in for a brief period, 1725 to 1727. But Anna is in from 1730 to 1740. Elizabeth is in from 1741 to 1762. And then after a brief interlude of Peter III, who is rapidly murdered, his grieving widow, irony, Catherine II, Catherine the Great, is monarch from 1762 to 1796. Now, I would not say that the fact that there are four sovereign tsarinas weakened monarchy, and indeed, in comparison with Peter II, the little baby Ivan who's there between Anna and Elizabeth, Peter III, who's quite frankly a Burke, and Paul I, another person who has to be murdered, I wouldn't say the males are capable of providing anything in particular between Peter the Great, Peter I, who dies in 1725, and Alexander, who comes in with the new century.
And I mean, France obviously has a long, despite some influential queen consorts, has a long line of male monarchs. The Habsburgs do as well until we come to Maria Theresa. How significant is Maria Theresa in both developing the role of queen and empress in Europe?
Right. Well, just again to for listeners, the Austrian Habsburg line in 1740 runs out in the male. Charles VI, the emperor, has daughters, and he has tried to get most of the German princes to sign up to what was known as the Pragmatic Sanction, which leaves his inheritance, the Austrian Habsburg dominions, to his elder daughter, Maria Theresa. She cannot become empress, Holy Roman Empress, and in fact never tries to. And what happens is it all goes disastrously wrong. People that had signed up to accept this immediately after he dies, the situation collapses, the War of the Austrian Succession is launched. One of the rivals, Karl Albrecht, Charles Albert of Bavaria, becomes the Emperor Charles VII in 1741. And then he dies in 45, and Maria Theresa's husband, Stephen Francis of Lorraine, is elected emperor. So that you have a situation thereafter until she dies, which was in 1780, of Maria Theresa as sovereign of the Austrian Habsburg dominions, and first her husband, and then after he dies in 1765, her eldest son, Joseph II, as Holy Roman Emperors. I think it's fair to say that Maria Theresa is quite an effective figure, actually, and in some respects, she's certainly more effective than Francis Stephen, or Francis Stephen, and she's certainly more successful than Joseph. So I think Maria Theresa offers a degree of continuity and competence. Now, clearly there were criticisms made of her. Frederick the Great was never one to resist sticking the pen in his correspondence, and Maria Theresa's devout Catholicism did not appeal to some of the Enlightenment writers, her rather traditional Catholicism. But I think she was quite an effective individual, and she also had a skill in picking good ministers and a skill in being willing herself to alter her foreign policies for what seemed to be better international partners. So yes, I would be reasonably reasonably impressed with Maria. I mean, it is interesting that in the 18th century, a number of countries, Portugal is another one, have reigning female monarchs, and some of them don't do too badly. It's not that not all of them do well, but some of them don't do too badly.
And coming back to the role of the consort, Marie Antoinette had to put up with a lot of pretty misogynistic criticism, you know, claims, fanciful claims that, you know, she was in a lesbian affair, and the Empress Alexandra, Nicholas II's wife of Russia, similarly, you know, being portrayed as being in a kind of psychosexual relationship with Rasputin and so on. Is this an ingrained level of misogyny that, you know, inevitably attracts itself to women, as misogyny does, but or actually should we just see it that there were particular perceived weaknesses in these characters which their enemies chose to exploit?
Well, you obviously read interesting history books, more interesting than the ones I write. I'm not sure that women necessarily have to put up with accusations about lesbian affairs, etc. I don't recall Queen Victoria having to put up with that sort of thing. Or,
oh, but, Anne did.
Anne did.
The Duchess of Marlborough.
Yes.
Hinted at.
Let's say this, that there is always in any political system criticism of the person at the top. And I think you could fairly, if you know, I'm sure we live in a woke age, and somebody listening this could easily put together a list of misogynist comments about women that were made at the time. But you could also put together a list of hostile comments made at the time about, let's say, homosexual monarchs, male homosexual monarchs. You could put together a list of hostile comments made at the time about monarchs who allegedly didn't like war enough, or monarchs who allegedly liked war too much. I've already been pretty disparaging about Charles I. I wasn't aware that I was doing so as part of some, you know, conspiracy, which would then mean that I would be, you know, designated in some listing of hostility towards X, Y, or Z. I mean, I think it's fair to say that most monarchs were criticized at some stage or the other for many things, including, irrespective of their alleged personality, simple failure. But other things that tend to be criticized are extravagance, favoritism, in other words, picking people that others didn't like, whereas if they picked them themselves, they would no doubt have been, you know, everybody would have said, what a prudent choice, Your Majesty. So extravagance, favoritism, there are all sorts of reasons that people tend to have a go at monarchs for. People of a relatively completely blameless personal life. George III, for example, got criticized for all sorts of things. So I don't think it's only women that get criticized. And, you know, you commented on Queen Anne and the criticism that is applied for her favoritism to Sarah, Duchess of Marlborough, and you were right. But let us bear in mind, if we wind back, her predecessor, William III, was accused of both homosexuality, male favourites such as Bentinck, plus being an illegitimate ruler, you know. His predecessor, James II, James VII of Scotland, was accused of the kitchen sink, but including autocracy and Catholicism. Charles II was not exactly an exemplary moral figure. It, you know, you can go on and on and on. George I had his wife locked up and possibly was complicit at the murder of his wife's lover. I mean, so in other words, I'm not sure that you should be arguing that it's simply women that got criticized.
Yes, well, that's...
But I could go on. I could go on, you know.
Well, someone who was never accused of being a lesbian was Queen Victoria. How well did she adapt the role? Is it the perception of her as a mother of the nation, a mother of empire? Were there ways in which being a queen were an advantage to her during her long reign?
Yes, I think so. I mean, to my mind, Queen Victoria revives the reputation of the British monarchy. She brings to a fulfilment the idea of the domestic monarchy, which had been very much endorsed by George III. She rescues it from the rakishness of George IV and the degree of eccentricity of William IV. I think William IV's very interesting, but I think it's fair to say, well, we don't really have the time to discuss him. Maybe we'll discuss him on another occasion. But Victoria manages to ground the monarchy in a way that is acceptable to the broad range of her subjects. Now, of course, there are assassination attempts. I think there's about six against Queen Victoria. And there are Republicans. And of course, in Ireland, there are Fenians. But the overwhelming majority of her subjects, including her successful visits to Dublin, which were very successful, see her in an extremely positive light. And I actually think that it's a very interesting pattern that you can draw from Queen Victoria to the modern, the next female sovereign, which is our current one, Her Majesty. And I think also, if you want to think about it, Queen Victoria very much steadies the ship in Britain. And that provides, I think, a significant background to the ability of the established system to you know, as it were, survive the storms of the 19-teens. So I've got a positive view of Queen Victoria. I think she had irritations, and people didn't always find that she understood at once what her ministers thought was her constitutional position. But I think one has to accept that the constitution was more fluid than some of them thought. And I would also suggest that Gladstone was not always the easiest of people to get on with. But no, I think Victoria is very impressive. And I think also she works well as a head of state for empire. I mean, it's very interesting. Many years ago, I helped to write the script for the series of David Starkey programmes on the monarchy in the 18th and 19th century. And I remember I said to him that they needed to do the one in the 19th century to start off after William IV, the idea of Albert as king of Britain. And that was in a way trying to think about something different to offer the audience. And Albert, of course, had a whole lot of very interesting ideas in terms of renewal, in terms of reform, in terms of activist government in the mid 19th century, and a very impressive figure in many respects. But I think obviously he died in the early 1860s, but I think in some respects he wasn't always as wise politically in the long term as Queen Victoria was.
When we come to the Queen Consorts of the 20th century, Alex and Mary, consorts of Edward VII and George V, did they develop any distinctive role themselves, or were they carrying on the sort of thing, you know, patronesses of charities and hospitals and good works and so on? Was that actually just something that had continued on that Queen Consorts have been doing for 100 years, maybe centuries?
Well, it was very much more in the public gaze. I mean, you have a society by the period you're talking about of newspaper photographs, you have a society of the Pathé news, you have, you know, cinema news reels. So I think it's fair. And also you have a society, I mean, where the charitable role of the monarchy is adapting to a larger than ever, in terms of population, society, than before. They're adapting to the mass male franchise and then the extension of the franchise to women as well. They're adapting to a society in which there is a working class political party, an explicitly working class political party in the case of the Labour Party, and a political party pledged to major constitutional change in the case of the Liberal Party. So I don't think it's a sort of passive background in which they can just play Lady Bountiful. And even before these strains of in which the First World War put paid to many traditional long-established monarchies, including obviously those of Austria, Russia, Germany and Turkey, with of course Russia and Germany allied dynastically very much to the British one, there were already changes prior to World War One. I mean, the extinction of the Portuguese royal family, which had been one that was close to its British counterpart. So I think that one has to be cautious about assuming that it's an easy role. And of course, in the case of Queen Mary, there is also the need to navigate the fact that Britain is at war with Germany in World War One, in an astonishingly difficult war, and a war in which there is a degree of Germanophobia. So, no, I think they both play an impressive role. I mean, obviously, their role is less central than that of their husbands, but they both play an impressive role.
And as we come up to the modern day, I mean, you drew a comparison with what the stability that Victoria brought in her long reign and also the force for stability that the current Queen, Queen Elizabeth II, has brought in her long reign as well. Is that the fundamental nature of the current Queen's contribution to British life, a stabilising role? Or there are aspects of queenship that she has that are personal to her that she has introduced to the role?
I suspect that an evaluation of Her Majesty will have to wait until the archives are open, although of course that won't stop lots of commentators rushing to comment prior to that. So in a way, I think one has to give impressions. I mean, I've only met the Queen once. That's when I was given an honour. We had the brief conversation. She showed herself extraordinarily perceptive about what we were talking about, which was stamps, because I got my honour for stamp design. I think that you have got a situation in which the monarch is the most experienced politician in the country. Somebody who is able to encompass as head of state and as a working head of state a tremendous range of business of the state, not just the formal business of government and the oversight of the political system, but also the way in which the state involves by necessity and by choice a whole range of voluntary and other activities, from religion, the armed forces, charitable institutions, the Commonwealth, and so on and so forth. So I think you've got, in the case of the present monarch, somebody who is astonishingly hardworking, very shrewd, very thoughtful, and actually has been a tremendously impressive figure. Now, I think if you were monarch for a long time, and obviously this was also true of Queen Victoria, of Elizabeth I, of George III, you have longer to get into the role and longer to make a success of it. And I think that's very much been the case of Her Present Majesty. There will obviously be issues that will come up in the archives in which she expressed a point of view. I suspect that she is probably keener on the Commonwealth than maybe some of her ministers. But on the other hand, that's her job. She is not just head of state of Britain, she is head of state of other countries as well. And that gives her a vantage point that maybe British commentators do not have. So no, I would envisage and anticipate a very positive account of the Queen from historians. And, you know, I think we've been jolly lucky that she's been the monarch for so long and has worked so incredibly hard at the role.
Well, that's a very positive note to end on, Professor Jeremy Black, for taking us through the role of Queens, Queens in their own right, and Queen's consort. Thank you very much indeed.
A pleasure.
If you've enjoyed listening to The Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.